You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 15th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
Kara is down under. She's on the other side of the world as we're recording this.
Looking at an upside down moon.
That's right. And she's too busy to join us. They have her very busy with, you know, radio spots and TV spots and everything. So, guys, I have some good news.
Ooh, tell me
about it.
Good news, everyone.
Good news.
Yeah.
A slight update in the lawsuit. Tobinick suing me for saying that he's selling medical treatments without sufficient evidence to back them up. It gets a little complicated because the case breaks down into different components. But basically, I won the main part of the case on summary judgment. And then Tobinick appealed. This is in federal court in the U.S. Then he appealed, and I won the appeal. So I won it at the appellate level. And then the only place to go from there is the Supreme Court. So Tobinick, of course, tried to appeal to the Supreme Court. You have to submit a writ to say, hey, we'd like you to review this case, and this is why the Supreme Court should be interested in it. And they just replied saying no.
No, thank you.
They're not going to hear the case. So that means—
Didn't he appeal? Didn't he try to go above the Supreme Court?
You can't. Like
there is no
the
above.
Galactic Federation or something?
Yes, Galactic Federation.
Yeah, so the main trial itself is now 100% over. He has nothing left that he could do.
Well, yeah.
He's out of options.
Yeah, right. But there's the other piece to the case, however, is the awarding of fees. So
yes.
I was awarded a significant amount of fees, basically saying that, you know, he took the case beyond all reason, after the judge determined essentially that my science-based medicine article that he complained about, that it was not commercial speech. That was basically the core theory of his lawsuit.
Which means commercial speech is that you're making money off of—
Well, there are specific criteria, but it basically means that the article was written primarily to further specific commercial ends, right? Like you're writing the article to sell something or to promote—
Well, yeah, you were promoting your cancer cure.
Yeah, right. Or that I was doing it to compete with him, you know, in some way. And the judge in the case laid out exactly why my article did not meet any of the criteria for commercial speech. So basically saying that there's no way you can consider this article commercial speech, which means that it's protected free speech, right?
Right.
So everything after that point, the judge deemed frivolous, and I basically got fees awarded for all of my expenses after that point. Plus also there were some fees attached to the California component of the case, because that was covered under an anti-SLAPP legislation in California. So he appealed that, right? He appealed that decision of awarding me fees. So that part still remains to be decided at the appellate level.
Oh.
Although oral arguments will be heard for that part in January. So I still haven't seen any money from this guy, you know, to cover our costs, you know, for this case, which are extreme. And but, you know, given that he lost so soundly, I mean, he basically is, you know, he lost in summary judgment. He got awarded fees. He lost the appeal. He tried to then say, yeah, he asked for what's called an en banc review. He's like, okay, I want all the judges in that circuit to appeal. They said no. He asked the Supreme Court. They said no. I mean, they're really slapping him down for everything that he's asking for in that regard. And then, so it's unlikely, it seems, that, you know, they will reverse the lower court on the fees. And then we have to ask for the fees, which we already have, but, you know, that hasn't been decided yet for all of the appeals, right? Because the appeals are costing as much as the original case.
Mm-hmm.
So he's dragging this out as long as he possibly can. And, you know, we're still having to deal with it. But at least the main part of the case now is officially 100% over. But I have to, there's something else I want to talk about, which is right before the Supreme Court denied him, he filed a supplement, basically like an argument for why the Supreme Court should hear the case and rule in his favor. He basically tried to argue that the science-based medicine is clickbait internet trolling and quote-unquote fake news for the purpose of making
money.
Wow.
He actually went the fake news route.
He played that card.
Yeah.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
So he says in his submission, this is what he writes. In its own briefing, it says, it is essential that our legal system recognize that there is a fundamental difference between fake news, i.e. publications that seek to disseminate to readers facts known to be false, and real news published by legitimate news organizations. Fake news disseminated by social media can be used not only to influence political results, but also to improperly interfere with U.S. commerce for the profit of an unscrupulous publisher. That's me, right?
Right.
So that was his latest theory of his case, was that science-based medicine is fake news. And it, even though I don't make a dime from science, nobody makes any money from science-based medicine. That's, you know, that's all nonprofit. Any donations that we get or any advertising goes to just pay for bandwidth and, you know, and just run the infrastructure. And also for, you know, Science-Based Medicine Day at Nexus, right, at our conference. So it's basically it all gets put back into what we're doing. Then as supportive evidence for this, he oddly used the SGU, which again doesn't publish science-based medicine and has nothing directly to do with it. The fact that we use social media in order to, you know, drive traffic to the Skeptics Guide to promote our podcast, basically.
Right.
But even still, like, Sharon's like, oh yeah, these guys use Facebook to funnel traffic to their podcast.
Okay.
As if that's somehow nefarious.
So go ahead and sue 500 million other entities doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is why his argument failed, because if, you know, this kind of activity made all speech commercial, then like everything the New York Times publishes is commercial speech,
right.
You know? So basically is the end of free speech in the United States.
Yeah, good luck with that.
You know, he went
if
for
his
it.
Theory were correct. Oh, my God.
Well, that's yeah. not – you know, I mean, talk about being totally detached from reality at that point.
We have no idea – we have no idea if he believes any of this. This is just his argument. This is a last-ditch desperation maneuver, in my opinion, and probably just hurt him because, you know, the awarding of fees is premised on the notion that he's being unreasonable. So him being unreasonable actually, you know, it just will make that case even easier.
What kind of lawyer takes this case? Who in their right practice would even touch this?
That's the thing, Ev. This guy scrolled through five lawyers. Since we've been in court with him, you know?
Yeah.
So he's even had a challenge finding a lawyer sort of willing to go along with him on this.
Officially, we don't know why, but you can make your own conclusions. But yes, he's on his fifth lawyer in this case.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's clearly – seems like it's going to have a very happy ending, and that's wonderful. But it's been years of hell.
Yeah.
And it's been a horrible experience. But – if it happens again, we're going to jump right back in the ring.
We'll do it again.
There's no way we're going to bow down, even though this was not fun. It's got to be done. Next time we'll have a fund ready to go.
But it's a good precedent.
To help defray the cause. It is.
It's a good precedent that, you know, he tried to drag us into the Lanham Act, which is the Commercial Speech Act, and, you know, tried to make the case the way he did. Because now we have a very good legal precedent that no, you cannot harass us legally in this way, right? So it'll make it easier to defeat anyone else who tries to go down that same road. And we could also point to the fact is, hey, we stuck this out all the way to the end, and we will do that. We will do so in the future. And the end result was, you know, probably, again, we have to wait until his second appeal and everything plays itself out. But if it plays out the way it's likely to. The only end result of this case is that Tobinick had to spend a lot of money for his own case, and he had to pay for a lot of my case, of my defense. This is just costing him a lot of money.
Ugh.
Okay, so going as expected, but yeah, the wheels of justice have to grind their way through this. Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
This week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I will talk about Mary Swartz Rose, 1874 to 1941. She was the founder and first woman president of what is now the American Society of Nutrition and created the United States' first program in nutrition. Rose, this one struck me. Rose got a BS in Household Arts in 1906. Household Arts, that that was a thing. It's kind of like a degree in home economics, right?
Home economics,
right?
I would think.
Yeah. So yeah, that was like, wow, that was actually a thing, household arts. She did, of course, get other degrees and lots of other education. She got a PhD under Lafayette Mendel in physiological chemistry in 1909. Definitely knew her stuff, as was totally borne out by her career. She soon started her career after graduating at Columbia University Teachers College, where she created with Henry Sherman the first program in nutrition for the United States. I love that another huge part of Rose's career was that she was a serious science communicator. And this, for average people, about what science was telling us about how to select foods and how to think about nutrition and things like that. I mean, this is like in the first half, third of the 20th century, up to the 1920s and 30s and stuff. I mean, this is valuable information that, people don't seem to know a lot about nutrition today in 2017. Imagine what their conceptions were back in the early 1900s. I mean, it must have been Paleolithic in what they believed. Check this out. She even had a hand in scientific recipes for the military in World War I, the army rations and things like that. So she had some really significant input. So just an amazing career in nutrition. And for somebody to do that in the time that we're talking about here is even more amazing. So remember Mary Rose. Mention her to your friends. Perhaps when discussing amylopectin, gluconeogenesis, or perhaps chrysolaminarin.
Interesting. All right, Evan, you're going to start us off with the news items with a scientist's warning.
Yeah, this report is, when I read it, I was also listening to a newscast about it, and the newscaster described it as both disturbing and sad, which it is, yet there are a few kernels of optimism to it. Now, it is a paper published in the peer-reviewed journal Bioscience on November 13th titled World Scientists' Warning to Humanity, A Second Notice. So it was 25 years ago that the Union of Concerned Scientists, along with more than 1,700 independent scientists, including the majority of living Nobel laureates in the sciences, penned the 1992 World Scientists' Warning to Humanity. Now, in that 1992 warning, they declared, and I quote, "A great change in our stewardship of the Earth and the life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided." They expressed concern about current, impending, or potential damage on the planet Earth involving ozone depletion, freshwater availability, marine life depletion, ocean dead zones, forest loss, biodiversity destruction, climate change, and continued human population growth. And they described how we are fast approaching many of the limits of what the biosphere can tolerate without substantial and irreversible harm. Now, this month, on the 25th anniversary of their call, scientists are looking back at their warning and evaluating the human response by exploring available time series data. And with the exception of stabilizing the stratospheric ozone layer, humanity has failed to make sufficient progress in all of these areas, in these foreseen environmental challenges, and they're getting worse. And if you look at these graphs that they offer as part of the paper, and they're very easy to read, the trend lines are scary. For example, we've got a few points here to point out. Between 1970 and 2012, vertebrates have declined by 58%. Freshwater populations declined by 81%, marine populations 36%, terrestrial populations declining by 35%. Total forests down 3%. We lost 3% of our forests since 1992. Temperature change obviously significantly on the rise since 1992 and getting worse. Our CO2 emissions continue to rise at an alarming rate. And of course, the population. I'm looking at the chart, and in the 1980s, where there was roughly about 5 billion humans, we're over 7 billion now, just 30 years later, essentially. And that is a trend line that is really, really stands out in all of this. They've also expressed, and it's something we've talked about on the show before, and I'm sure our listeners have read about, the sixth mass extinction. Sixth in roughly 540 million years, where many current life forms could be annihilated or at least committed to extinction by the end of this century. So it is a doom and gloom sort of report as to where we stand 25 years later after the initial warning that they're giving us, and they're giving us another warning this time. But there are examples of a few good things as part of this report. As I mentioned earlier, global decline in ozone-depleting substances, that is trending downward, so that's very good. There have also been advancements in reducing extreme poverty and hunger. There's a rapid decline in fertility rates in many regions attributable to investment in girls' and women's education. A promising decline in the rate of deforestation in some regions of the planet. And there's also the rapid growth in renewable energies. So, yes, there are some things to point at, which are actually good, but it's not enough. It is far from sufficient. And this is the clarion call again to make sure that we start making corrections. And they also list a bunch of things that people can do, both as individuals and as larger societies and states throughout the world.
So there's another layer to this story, though, Evan, and that is the Union of Concerned Scientists themselves. So while in, you know, the things that they're talking about in this article, I think, are all legitimate, they are an activist organization. And sometimes they get criticized because they present themselves as a scientific organization when they're in fact an activist organization. Mm-hmm. Right. Just their name, the Union of Concerned Scientists, you know, implies that they're primarily a scientific organization. And that's not true. The issue on which this is most glaring is, and you might guess this, GMOs. You know, they write papers and everything, you know, position papers, et cetera. And they're writing on GMOs. They're trying to be scientific, but they essentially reject the scientific consensus, and they write, you know, fear-mongering summaries of, like, the dangers of GMOs. They really don't put it into a proper context, and clearly they're showing their ideological bias. You know, for example, they warn about super weeds, you know, in quotes.
Like, what do you mean? Like, really potent marijuana?
Yeah. No, it's a really great example of how you can distort, you know, reality ideologically. For example, by using glyphosate-resistant crops, mm-hmm. we are creating the existence of glyphosate-resistant weeds, right? There's no question that that's happening. Whatever technique we use for weed control, the weeds will become resistant to it. Like any chemical that we use, for example, they'll become resistant. That's just a selective pressure, which is why we need to use integrative pest management, right? You need to use a variety of methods to try to minimize resistance to any one. But they use the existence of resistance to glyphosate in particular as if this is somehow a danger to health or to the environment by creating these super weeds, right? Doesn't that sound dangerous? Oh, no. These super weeds are going to take over. But the thing is, they're only quote-unquote super in that they resist this one herbicide.
Yeah, one
That's
herbicide.
That's it. That they're no more dangerous than any other weed. They're just not going to respond well to glyphosate, right? So there's no risk. What's ironic is the same people who warn about super weeds, i.e. resistant to glyphosate, are calling for glyphosate to be banned. Oh, so you don't want to use the one herbicide that these weeds will be resistant to. Therefore, their resistance means nothing.
Mm-hmm. You're right? Saying that resistance is futile?
Resistance is futile.
Nice.
But anyway, it's a way to make it sound scary, to make GMOs sound scary, because they're creating these super weeds. They've had a fight with journalist Keith Clore, who totally called them out on their hypocrisy, because, you know, they take certain positions, like on global warming, and they talk about the scientific consensus and this and that, and then they violate all of their own rules when it comes to things like GMOs.
Yeah.
I've read different things about their position on nuclear power, and I think they might have evolved their position recently, because initially I think they were very anti-nuclear power.
I recall that from many years ago that was definitely one of their boogeymen.
I just read their, you know, some of their papers on nuclear power to see what they're saying now. And now they're saying, yeah, we probably are going to need nuclear power to combat climate change, mm-hmm. but we just want to make nuclear power as safe as possible. which I think is a perfectly reasonable position. So that at least what they're saying now, at least in this one paper that I'm reading by the Union of Concerned Scientists, I think is a reasonable position. Although some people still criticize them for emphasizing renewable energy disproportionately over nuclear, but whatever. That's actually not unreasonable. You know, that's not that's fine.
Well, then,
because there is, it's not like they're going against a specific scientific consensus by saying, "Oh, we should emphasize renewables over nuclear." At least they're saying, "Yes, nuclear is fine. We can, we probably will need it, but we just want to make it safe by having effective regulations."
They're not. They're not including their GMO position as part of this warning.
No, they're not. I think everything in this particular warning is fine. Although, if you look at some of the charts, they do that total bad chart thing where they...
Not the bad chart thing.
Well, the left side of the chart, you know... What
doesn't
do you call
go
it?
To zero.
It doesn't go to zero, yeah. So you look at the total forest, it looks like it's plummeting, but it's like, no, it's from 4.1 to 4.0. That's the range of the chart.
Oh, my God.
That's deceptive. So it's deceptive charting.
Well, to those who don't know how to read charts, I suppose. But they even acknowledge, I believe they even acknowledge that, that it's not, that they tell you to pay attention. Yeah, here, note that the y-axis do not start at zero. So they made a point to try to point that out.
But still, you know that people are going to look at those freaking charts and go, oh my God, the forests are going away.
Well, that is true. You look at the lines themselves and they, you know,
it's not an accurate depiction of the data on those charts. But whatever, you got it. You have to show it, you know, in context of the percentage, you know, whereas other ones, it does go to zero when it makes sense.
Right.
But yeah, but in other ones, they don't. They just sort of arbitrarily choose whatever range they want to use to sort of make the chart look maximally dramatic, which I disagree with.
So in this instance, though, they happen to be correct about global warming, but overall they're
well,
they're
I think
kind of
that, yeah, I wouldn't say that they're bogus.
They're
I think
not
that
bogus.
They are an ideological activist organization, and they need to be understood that way first and foremost. And they really shouldn't be confused with an objective scientific organization.
Yes, I agree with that.
So, and I think it also raises an interesting issue, and that is, how should scientists behave when they want to be politically active? And is it okay for them to be politically active as scientists, or should they separate their political activism from their authority as scientists? And when they speak from their authority as scientists, should they make an effort to be politically neutral? Right?
Huh. Yeah.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to confuse your scientific authority with your political activism. That I think that's a legitimate point.
Yep. Sure.
Yeah, and in good days, that's a fine line to walk, you know, and it gets trickier over time.
But they obliterate that line. They are progressive activists, which is fine. I have no issue with that. But they do their ideological activism as scientists, and they totally blur that line. And it becomes a serious problem on issues where the science isn't quite in line with their ideology, like GMOs.
So should the takeaway here be, yes, pay attention to the warnings, but also understand who's delivering the message?
Exactly. And I just think that's the reason why this is a problem, because it's an opening. And if you read the response to this from the right,
they're
dismissing it because of this very issue. They're using all of these things I talked about in order to dismiss this message. So it actually does weaken their message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Backfire effect in a way.
Yeah. It's complicated. It's very complicated.
It is complicated.
So this reminds me of a cool little short story for a science fiction podcast. There was actually a group in the story that was called the Union of Concerned Robotic Scientists. And it was awesome.
Yeah, probably an homage.
We are programmed to be concerned.
All right. Jay, tell us about these smart pills.
Whoa, yeah.
Do they make you smarter?
Yeah, no. They do. You mean you just take three or four of them and you feel really good, man. You might think you're smarter, but you're not. No, these are digital pills. They're digital.
What?
Yep, you either swallow a one or a zero.
Binary.
Now, they're called digital pills, and what they do is they track when a patient has swallowed a pill, and the FDA has approved it. So this is a milestone, guys, in medicine.
Wait,
for
this
real.
Is a pill? This is a pill that tracks when you swallow other pills? What?
No, itself.
Itself, yeah. So the FDA approved the digital pill, and it has an embedded sensor in it, and that sensor communicates – to a patch that is attached to the patient's torso, and that patch communicates to the smartphone, and it allows the doctors to track the drug's use. So, you know, at first, you know, take a look at this thing, and I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool. And then, you know, it's a little weird, too, because you have a sensor that you're eating, and it's going to be communicating activity. But, you know, I'm a fan of this type of technology because I think, you know, it started with, like, swallowing a camera.
Yes.
And then it evolves into this, you know, where we can now tell if a patient is taking the drug. So your stomach fluids actually turn the sensor on. And that's when it starts to transmit. And then it sends, like I said, it sends signals to the patch and then to your phone. The phone is an app, right? And that app is connected to the internet. And your physician could read how often you're taking the drug. You know, so the most important data here is the medication being taken? That's the purpose of this particular. Yeah. The interesting thing is a lot of people that have emotional issues like depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, a lot of them have a hard time staying on their medication for varying reasons. And this kind of medication, you know, that's effective in treating these conditions, they need to take it every day. It's a daily med. And in the worst cases, like say a schizophrenic patient doesn't take their medication for a day or two or three, they could have a psychotic break, which could, you know, land them in the ER, which is bad and very costly. And, you know, it's a horrible experience for the patient and, you know, bad things can come of going off some certain types of meds too. Like you really do need to take them. And if you're going to go off them, you need to go off them with a strategy. You can't just stop taking it cold turkey. So patients can also report other information though. They can report how they feel, if they think the meds are working, how their sleep is, whatever. Some patients report that their meds aren't working, and there are suspicions that in a lot of cases, people aren't taking their drugs on the schedule that they're supposed to. So this will help the doctors understand better the use of the drug, the effectiveness of the drug. So on that level, it seems like it's a great thing. Now, there is a question if this technology has a legitimate privacy issue. And I think, you know, just like anything else, especially, you know, the digital us, there's always a privacy issue. Patients have to agree that their physicians can see the information that the app is collecting. They also can allow other people to see the data. And then, of course, the pharmaceutical company wants to see that data. And they're saying, we just want to see it anonymously with the patient's consent so they can do large-scale tracking and analytics. All sounds good on paper, but still, you know, it really is, you can look at it, to me, it's like a slippery slope. Like, sure, the digital pill can tell you if I'm taking the pill. And then, you know, 2 years later, well, sure, it could tell you, you know, where I am because my phone has a GPS. So now you're going to get like, you know, oh, sure, you know, you can look into my contacts list. Oh, sure, you can, you know, X, right? Right? It's infinite. It connects you in yet another way. So I don't want to just come down on the technology itself. I think it's progress. I think it's very powerful. I think that information is beautiful. You know, like it's valuable. But of course, there has to be, from the very beginning, we should be saying, up, red flags, let's talk about the privacy issues. And hey, you big, you know, multi-billion dollar companies, don't get any wise ideas. Say, you know, like just keep it in your pants, guys, because you're not going to, you know, this isn't another way to find out everything about every human being on the planet. You know, so I love it, but let's be careful.
Didn't we talk about this with these smart meters and the home electricity?
Yeah, we did. I mean,
it's kind of
anytime,
a similar discussion in a way.
Exactly, man. Exactly. Anytime you're connected, that there's another data point, another angle. You know, Ev, your information is already out there. They've already got everything about you. It's already digitized. It's already.
Thank you, Equifax.
Yeah, you know, then you have Equifax comes swinging with a vengeance, you know, dumping everybody in the United States and some people in the UK, all their data got breached, all of it. You know, it's like, yeah, that's the danger. You know, we're just waiting for the third, fourth, and, you know, 500th boot to fall on the ground. It's coming.
So this is a good technology, the idea of, you know, they embed this like little grain in the tablet and as it dissolves. And
well, of course, you agree with it, Steve.
But hang on. In the best case scenario, just if you look at the utility side, not the abuse side, if you could have information about the patient's compliance with medication, that would be really useful.
Right.
It's not uncommon, for example, for, let's say, a patient who is being treated for seizures to have a seizure, and then the doctor increases their medication dose to better control their seizures. But they only had the seizure because they were noncompliant. And so the increasing the dose is not the appropriate response. And right now we have monitor compliance by just asking the patient, you know, how they took their medication. And for many of the medications, we can check levels, but not all of them. But even then, there's other variables in there. Like they may have just taken their medication, you know, so the level will look good, but you don't know if it's good all the time. So it not only just are they taking their pills, but are they taking them on a reasonable time scale? You know, like are they taking doses 12 hours apart, for example, or are they just forgetting and then taking them all at night or something? So we give a lot of information for medications where we have to carefully monitor compliance. Most patients in situations like that, I would have no problem, you know, giving their physician that information. You know, that's obviously in the context of a therapeutic relationship that's protected by patient confidentiality. Of course, you know, schizophrenics, this is like exactly the thing they would be paranoid about, right? So if you don't want to take the medication for whatever reason, or, you know, if you don't have a relationship that where you trust your healthcare provider, I don't know if this is going to really solve anything. And it also should be said that using this, it seems that this kind of thing would be really useful to remind patients to take their medication.
Yeah.
But the studies that we have so far show that this kind of approach doesn't work, which means that people aren't taking their medication. A lot of the times it may be because they don't want to. And so, you know, having your smartphone remind you to take a medication isn't going to fix that problem.
Well, how about antibiotic abuse?
What do you mean?
Or lack of finishing your antibiotics. And the reason why antibiotics are so screwed up today is because of that. Like how about if you're going to take antibiotics, you have to take all of them. There's a legitimate reason why people need to finish their antibiotics. And the doctors could see that they're not taking the medication.
Well, first of all, while that's conventional wisdom, there was a recent study which showed it's not necessarily true.
Whoa, forget it.
I know.
All right.
Tell me what I don't know.
What happened?
Well, they looked at the incidence of antibiotic resistance if patients stopped taking antibiotics when they felt better versus completing the course of antibiotics. In some cases, completing the course beyond the point where you're asymptomatic actually was worse than just stopping when you felt better.
What? Has that been replicated?
So no, it was one study. It hasn't been replicated. So, but it does at least make this from ironclad to an open question, you know. In other words, once the infection's gone, you should stop your antibiotics. But how do you really know the infection is gone? If, you know, do you just go by your symptoms, which may only tell you that they're 98% gone, and it's that 2% that you got to worry about? Or do we use the predetermined duration? And how well evidenced is that predetermined duration? It's obviously going to be case by case. So it's a lot more complicated than you think is the bottom line. I would still say, even with this single study, take your full course of antibiotics as prescribed. But FYI, we're still investigating exactly what the best thing to do is. And those recommendations may change, you know, as new evidence comes in. We may need to use other methods of figuring out how long to take antibiotics other than just a predetermined set interval for everybody, you know, with a specific indication. But, and then, you know, and again, it's like the studies so far show that even if you get, like, if I know for sure that the patient's not compliant and we try to give them a nudge to take it, if they don't feel like taking it, it's not going to have that much of an effect. You know what I mean?
Yep.
At the end of the day, the patient still will need to want to take the medication. But where this will help with genuine forgetting, right? Like if you really do want to be compliant with your medications, but you just genuinely forget, then this kind of, you know, technology could be helpful with that.
Well, what if they put the this tracking pill in their friend or their pet?
Oh, feed it to the dog, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh no, that's terrible, Bob.
Or if it's a capsule, they can empty out the medication and just swallow the capsule. That wouldn't work if it's a tablet, where the tablet literally has to dissolve in stomach acid in order for the chip to be activated.
Gee whiz.
Yeah.
Install a sensor inside their esophagus or something. See if it passes by it like a barcode scan.
Right. Bleep, but then but you're right, Jay. We do have to think about how this could be abused, even if it may not seem obvious. You know, this information would be useful to somebody other than your physician. But patient confidentiality, you know, is an issue in a lot of ways, and you know there are methods to protect it. You know, at least legally, the framework is there to protect it. Okay, let's move on. So recently there was a survey published recently looking at how Facebook is doing in terms of their efforts to thwart fake news, right? Talking about fake news on Facebook, right?
Yep.
So
yes.
You guys remember we talked about this previously. What Facebook did is they contracted with journalists at various organizations to fact check articles. And then if articles were not legit, they would label them as disputed. Facebook claims that this reduces the degree to which those articles that get labeled disputed are being spread on Facebook. So mission accomplished. However, the survey tells a more nuanced story that is not so favorable and indicates that this effort may not be working. So Yale researchers Rand and Pennycook, gotta love that name, Pennycook.
I do like that.
Yeah, they found only tiny effects overall to this whole system of labeling quote-unquote fake news as disputed. And in fact, they found that there may be negative effects and that the negative effect may be better, maybe bigger than the positive effect.
Oh, great.
The thing is, they can't get to every article. So any article that is fake news but that didn't get captured, that fell below the radar, people are more likely to believe it because it's not labeled as disputed. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the net effect may, in fact, be negative. And this also makes it easy for fake news generating organizations to just to create a lot of what I call flack, right? You can just create a lot of really
smoke.
Obviously fake news in order to provide cover for the propaganda that you really want to sneak through the radar, right?
Yeah, it's like a denial of service attack almost in a way. You just throw out so much information that you can't handle it all.
The Guardian also reported on this. Their point was interesting. They said that by contracting with these news organizations as their fact checkers, that actually insulates Facebook from those same journalists writing about and objectively evaluating how they're doing. So they just created a conflict of interest. And, you know, in the most cynical view, they essentially used this as a way of purchasing, you know, positive reviews, like positive PR. We'll just hire the journalists who would call us out on it, you know, for spreading fake news. You know, they stopped short of accusing Facebook of deliberately doing that. They were more pointing out there's a potential conflict of interest here. In any case, you know, the whole thing is a big experiment. Social media is a massive experiment, and Facebook is an experiment, and Facebook's attempt at curbing fake news is an experiment. And so far, it certainly hasn't been a home run success. And in fact, it may be not working at all, or maybe even a net negative.
Detrimental.
It's just further confusing the whole, or muddying the whole picture, you know, because then you have these, you know, fake news articles that are not disputed. And then in some echo chambers, the disputed tag becomes a badge of honor, right?
Right.
Yeah, oh, look, the lamestream media thinks we're disputed, you know.
The lamestream.
Yeah.
It helps them dig in their heels even more and say to their people, hey, look what's happening here. Don't fall for this. Don't fall for these police people of the of what's real news and what's not.
So, yeah, so it's still an inherent issue that we have. You know, the social media is essentially an experiment with the extreme democratization of information. Of course, there's some positive aspects to that, but that represents almost a complete loss of any editorial or quality control filters, which means that people can spread clickbait, which is basically just items made to appear as news, but designed to be shocking and to drive clicks, but not optimized for quality or transparency or anything that we would value.
Yep.
And also then deliberate propaganda where you're just trying to, affect opinions. And again, you don't care about accuracy or quality, only about your whatever opinion that you're trying to be an activist for, to drive. Or I guess marketing would be in there too, right? And we see that as well. A lot of supplement companies, you know, have hit upon this where they have a fake news article that's made deliberately to look like it's coming from a news organization that says, oh, like busted, read the truth about this supplement. And it leads to an advertisement for their supplement, right?
Wow.
So they're pretending to be, you know, a skeptical site debunking their own product to lure people into their own product, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So
Whatever works, man.
That's scurrilous.
And that is literally fake news because it's pretending to be news, but it's just a deceptive marketing ploy.
Yeah, advertising.
So that's what we're dealing with. And, you know, the editorial filters are not there. So I think we do need to continue experimenting with how we can have other mechanisms of either transparency or quality control at the same time preserving this sort of free flow of information. And, you know, again, I think we also need to wrestle with, like, what are the consequences of all this? Is maybe, you know, some people might argue that the freedom is worth it. You know, that's the price you pay for freedom and it's fine. You know, and other people might argue that it's a huge societal problem because we basically don't have any basis for any shared common facts. You know, everything is an alternative fact. Everything that you don't like is fake news. There is no reality anymore. And that is it's a recipe for totalitarianism also. Yeah. You know, some people are beginning to question whether or not our democracy is sustainable without having a common source of information and facts that we could at least agree upon some basics, you know?
That's what's really scaring me right now.
That's kind of an extreme view, but I think there's reason to take it seriously to an extent at least. We have to keep our eye on this. You know, I think, you know, especially given what's happened in this country over the last year. I mean,
at least the government's got their act together, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Did you guys see John Oliver's last show of the season?
Yeah, it was profoundly perfect.
No way.
Awesome.
Yeah, he summarizes the three things that Trump does to essentially put up smoke screens, take advantage, and manipulate those who listen to him. One of them, of course, is being an expert troll. So, you know, having trolling as a skill set, like bow hunting skills, right? It's a thing now. The other thing is whataboutism. If you get asked a direct question, you don't answer the question. You say, well, what about
Hillary.
The Clintons? What about Obama? Yeah. What about blah, blah, blah? It doesn't matter.
Misdirection, deflection.
Yeah, exactly. And the first one was delegitimizing the media.
Yep.
Right? Again, that's the fake news thing. Anything you don't like is fake news. And so there is no legitimate information. And this is, you know, how despots function, right? Because if you can control information, then how can anybody be held to account, right? So, and Trump does use this to evade being held to account for the things that he says. Like everything he says has built-in plausible deniability because he's so imprecise in how he speaks. And then when you call him on, he's like, well, I don't know. Who knows anything? You know, whatever. He just wiggles his way out of it by just saying all this false equivalency.
Or you can interpret that any way you want.
So he's communicating almost entirely in dog whistles, you know, meaning that people hear what they want to hear and he's not held accountable for anything. There's no facts. There's no truth. There's no reality. It's all fake news.
It's just all whatever.
Yeah, it's all spin. And again, you know, I feel compelled to say this whenever we bring this up because we're not a political show. This is not about party, about tribalism. It's not about the politics. This is just about the basics of our democracy and the basics of truth, right? This is just the basics of facts and reality. In a lot of ways, I do think that, you know, the way that Trump and his supporters approach things is an assault on reason. It's an assault on truth, on basic facts, on journalism, on transparency. But coming from the left, we would be against it. This transcends politics. This is not about ideology at all. But anyway, I think that these things are all tied together, you know, the whole, you know, fake news on Facebook and the way the current administration approaches information and social media. Yeah. You know, I do think he's our first troll president. He basically trolled his way into the White House, and that's scary, you know. And when you listen to people defend him, you know, I've personally had online and personal conversations with people who defend him, who the chief thing they cite about what they like about him is that he makes so many people angry. Although he's upsetting the media and he's upsetting all the other people. That's what I like about him. He's mixing things up and they're basically just championing him as a troll.
As a firebrand,
without appreciating what that really means.
Yeah, they like the chaos because we all know chaos is a ladder.
Well, you can get you can get lost in the chaos. It's easy to maneuver in the chaos and you can twist things to however you want them to sort of suit your goals or your positions, your opinions.
If you're angry or if you feel powerless, there's a short-term thrill to the chaos, but it's not going to serve anyone.
Yeah, it's the dark side of the force. It's the easy, quick way to power. Like, but you know, seriously, as much as that, you know, that's funny. It's the freaking truth. You have to get up early and work hard all day. You have to. That's what being an adult means. You know, you can't just say what you want when you want and try to get the response out of people that you want without your words actually having meaning, without there being legitimate intent behind it. And that's what we're seeing with all the fake news and manipulation and lying and lies upon lies. I mean, at one point, you know, Steve made an exceptionally important point tonight. You know, we've passed a barrier here where we don't even have a shared truth anymore. We can't even talk about science with respect, you know, without, you know, we're questioning things that shouldn't be questioned anymore. When flat earth theory comes back with a vengeance, that is a clear sign that we have a massive problem. Not a coincidence either.
I don't think that's a coincidence. The fact that something as patently absurd as thinking that the earth is flat, and yes, people really do believe that. I have to say that every time as well. That can flourish to the extent that it is, even though it's on the fringe, is also, I think, a phenomenon that is related to all of this. That could only occur in a fake news, conspiracy mongering, nothing is real world, right? It's growing in the environment that in which people can actually believe that all scientists in the world are engaged in this conspiracy to convince us about the shape of the world, you know, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing, just absolutely amazing.
So something that I've been bouncing around in my head lately.
That's what that noise was.
I thought, Bob, you were going to say it was more of a rattle.
It's the idea that can we actually roll things back from where they've escaped out to at this point? Like, can fake news ever truly be rolled back? Can we, you know, bring respect back and legitimacy back to people's understanding of science and you know, their ability to accept this information as truth? Or when the genie is out of the bottle, it's truly out of the bottle and it's too late. And
I think it's too late, but not necessarily in a bad way. But not necessarily in a bad way. What I think is we can't go backwards. We could never go back. What we have to do is chart a course forward. We have to figure out where we go from here. I do think we could make things better, but it's just not going to be the way they were previously. We need new ways to make things function. Yeah. I think part of that is everything that we're trying to do is people need to be skeptical and critical thinkers, and they have to be able – there's no filter out there. We're basically functioning without a net, which means everyone's on their own. We have to make a massive effort to teach the skills necessary to sort through all this by ourselves, you know? Yeah. But I do think we also need to think about what kind of infrastructure can we put in place that will help people do that. I don't think the editorial filters are coming back. I think we need to explore other ways of dealing with this issue. And I don't have the answer, just that we need to really think a lot about this and experiment. All right, let's move on. All right, Bob, how fast are electrons?
Well, it depends what you mean. Maybe this would be a little clearer. Scientists have advanced atophysics, having for the first time precisely measured how fast an electron is ejected from an atom. And it's fast. This achievement comes from Marcus Isinger and others, all researchers from the Lund, Stockholm, and Gothenburg in Sweden. So I'll just give you the bottom line. They determined that electrons are ejected from atoms in 0.000000000002 seconds. A lot of zeros. That's 20 attoseconds, or 20 billionths of a billionth of a second. So yeah, wow. that it happens fast. So to time an event so precisely, you need a hell of a stopwatch, right? So quiz time. So what kind of stopwatch do you think they used?
Atomic stopwatch.
Come on, people.
A watch that...
Quantum.
Nope.
Wait.
Nano watch. Nano stopwatch.
Nano watch. All right. Not even good answers. This was done using the fastest lasers on the planet.
Lasers. Yep, I know it. Lasers.
Attosecond lasers, tiny pulses of laser light lasting only billionths of a billionth of a second. So that's what they, that's what you need, to see, you know, slices of time this tiny. So they used these pulses on a neon atom. And if you looked at textbooks up to now, they would say something like that when the proper type of light hits an atom, the electrons absorb the light. And then an instant later, the electron can escape the hold the atom had on it. Well, now we are confident that that instant is about 20 attoseconds, which I think qualifies as an instant. So this is called photoionization. When electromagnetic radiation interacts with the matter, it can disassociate the matter, creating charged particles, right? You lose an electron, you got some ions going on. So Einstein was the pioneer of this effect. Yeah. In fact, it was his only Nobel Prize, which I just love that little factoid from history that his only Nobel Prize. And this is a guy that deserved maybe like five of them at least. He only got a Nobel for photoionization, specifically the photoelectric effect, which we've talked about many times on the show. So this is big because chemical reactions, basically. All chemical reactions are essentially about electrons. They move, the electrons move between atoms and molecules, destroying some bonds, creating new bonds, and creating essentially chemistry. So learning about how that, you know, learning about the objects that do the real heavy lifting for chemical reactions. I mean, how can we go wrong by knowing that? So Marcus Isinger says that following such a process in real time is a bit of a holy grail within science. We have now come one step closer. He continues, being able to observe how molecules exchange electrons during a chemical reaction opens a door to completely new types of studies of a number of fundamental biological and chemical processes. So this is going to definitely be a fun ride. I predict that you'll be hearing a lot more about attophysics in the near future if you haven't been hearing about it already.
Okay.
I always think of attaboy when you say that.
Attaboy. Oh, yeah.
Attaboy. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Yes, last week I played this noisy. What is it?
A Ferengi teleporter, transporter.
It is not that, but that's so close, Evan.
Ooh.
Well, I'll give you a couple of answers that listeners sent in. So Virginia Camille said, at first she thanked us for the show and said she was pissed that she missed last week's. This week sounds like somebody stuck in the transporter from Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, no, but seriously, something to do with the sound of deep space, radio waves, or radio bursts. This is wrong, but interesting, because once I do tell you what this is, it's odd to hear how many things can sound alike. And just keep that in mind as you do find out what it is. Someone else wrote in that they think that this week sounds exactly like what I'm about to play for you, and this is not the answer. This is what they think it sounds like. What is it, Steve?
Sounds like the TARDIS in the background.
That's a TARDIS. Yep, and here's another TARDIS sound. Pretty similar. Yep, that's the TARDIS. Zachariah Coate thought that it sounded like the TARDIS. Thanks for the email, but that is wrong as well. But I do see a slight similarity. So, guys, this was that noisy. I'll play it again just to quickly remind you since I'm two noises away. That is the sound of crickets slowed way down.
What?
Cool. Yeah, that's a cricket song.
I wouldn't.
Slowed way down. And of course,
I never would have guessed it.
It's slowed down, but it's pitched back up. So it's still within human hearing. But this is interesting because the person, Andrew, who sent in the original sound file to me, ended up sending me in crickets slowed down, but it was fake.
Oh.
And it was fake because the person that created the file made it sound like an angelic chorus.
Uh-huh.
Which were, you know, saying that, yeah, when you slow crickets down, it's angels singing. But it was faked, which I vetted that out. So, Andrew, thanks for sending it in. The original sound file that he sent in had a much more song-like sound to it.
Just to clarify, the one you played is not fake, but he sent you another version
fake.
Of it,
yes.
Which was...
Yes, he sent one that somebody else made where they did slow it down, and it probably, you know, the root of it, it was similar to the cricket thing that I played for you, but it had like a, you know, like some, you know, human-like singing voices over it. Nope. Yeah, I found out that to be fake, but still a wonderful idea. This is a brilliant idea that people had to record the chirping of crickets, you know, slow it down, the speed, but pitch it up so we could still hear it. And it has this, you know, space-like sound to it, this, you know, reverberating planetary buzz type of noise that we've heard so many times on Who's That Noisy. Beautiful, very, very wonderful natural sound, just manipulated so we can hear it in a different way. Thank you very much for sending that in. Cool. I have a wonderful noisy for you this week. This noisy, the idea of this noisy was sent in by a listener named Jory Hokkanen. Thank you, Jory, and sorry that I can't pronounce your last name. So he sent me, I'll give you, and this is a hint. There were two different versions or two different kinds of this thing I'm about to play for you. He sent me the other one. I listened to both, and I happened to like the second one a little bit better. I thought it was more appropriate. So check this out, and I need you to tell me what this is. What is that?
Is that Deepak Chopra and his boy band?
You can't write in and say it's a song.
Okay, I'm deleting my email.
Right. Everyone's like, damn. Yeah, you got to be very specific. It's really interesting and very impressive. So if you have an answer, if you heard something really cool this week, something you think that other people need to hear, email it to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Dunk, Shane. Evan, we're going to do one quick correction this week. A few listeners called you out on your whole statement that the German alphabet doesn't have the letter Y. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, my faulty memory at work basically is what I'm calling out, and no surprise there. But here's how it went down. So several episodes ago, I had made a comment that the German alphabet did not have the letter Y, that it was essentially a 25-letter alphabet when comparing it to the English alphabet. But that is wrong, first of all and foremost. The letter Y actually does exist. And thinking back on it a little bit more now, my recollection is actually this, that I've taken 4 years of German in high school, and we used a dictionary throughout the 4 years. Now, upon receiving the dictionary, I was looking through some things and noticed that they did not have any words that began with the letter Y in this particular German alphabet. And I have a memory of going to my German teacher to ask him about that. And although I can't say I recall with any sort of clarity his exact answer, I recall him saying something that sort of satisfied to me that, all right, there is no word that, at least at the time, I thought began with Y, and he answered that to whatever satisfaction at the time I deemed appropriate, and sort of went on with that vague memory in my head all these years. But obviously, there is the letter Y used in the German language. It's a not an often used letter, but it definitely is there, and there are some cases in which. Words do begin with the letter Y. Epsilon was certainly the one that was pointed out to me by the most people. Now, in my 4 years of German, I don't ever recall having to utter the word Epsilon or anything else like it. So I had no memory of there ever being a German word beginning with Y. So that's the backstory as to my comment that I made on the actual episode. So, and that therefore is my correction.
Okay. Yeah, that happens sometimes. We have these little factoids stuck in our head that we just take for granted and they're just not true. They just either they were wrong at the time that we thought we learned them or our memory shifted over the years. But it's hard, you know, we have sort of an open-ended discussion on this show to vet every single factual claim that's even implied in our statements.
Yeah, but we, you know, as skeptics can't blame each other for having the junk, you know, it's that just that junk memory that we have from our childhood and from college and from whatever. I mean, you could actually be hearing a TV in the background while you're at a restaurant. Information could pass into your mind from that. You know what I mean? Like literally from a news station that's at a restaurant where you're having a conversation that could become a fact to you. That's how bad our memory is. That's how, you know, unreliable the information that we have in there is. You know, we have to suspect everything. So even like Evan's memory about the German language, you know, he was wrong. I mean, we openly and happily admit it. You know, of course, like we don't care.
Right. And I'm 30 years removed from practicing any German, frankly, in my life. So it's kind of no wonder that something like that is, you know, one of the things seated somewhere in my brain that I refer to. Yet, you know, had I done a little bit of more current research on that, I definitely would have known
thing.
That
it's,
to not
yeah,
be right.
It's a good reminder that we have to
be vigilant.
We have to be vigilant. We have to vet everything.
Yeah, especially you know, hey, the older the memory, the chances are that it's less reliable, and you should, you know, maybe double check those things. In fact, I went and looked for the actual German dictionary to see if I still had it, and unfortunately, I could not find it anywhere in my boxes of books. But I did go and try to look for it to try to, you know, do my due diligence in a sense and trying to figure out exactly what my recollection was.
Yeah, the problem is if you're doing a news show, like a pure news show, then you're everything's scripted and vetted. But when you're doing like a free flowing conversation interspersed with interesting news, stuff like that's going to happen. I mean,
so I apologize to everyone and my German speaking listeners out there, especially to all of you. Jawohl begins with a J, not a Y. And that one you can look up.
All right, thanks, Evan. Okay, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake.
Fake news.
It's fake news. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. Jay, what do you think the theme is?
It's got to be Thanksgiving, Steve.
I hope.
No.
Close. Taunt me. You know I'm the master of all things Thanksgiving.
So it was a couple years ago I did Thanksgiving as a theme. And then last year, if I recall, I did Native Americans as a theme. And so this year, because this is the last episode we're recording before Thanksgiving.
It is.
Next week's episode is going to be our private show from SciCon, which is a lot of fun, by the way.
That was good.
This year, for the Thanksgiving episode, the theme is early settlers. Okay. So it's not about Thanksgiving itself, it's just about early settlers the Americas.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Okay.
Sure.
All right, here we go. Item number one, the New Haven colony, founded in 1638, was considered the most progressive in New England. Their charter guaranteed religious freedom, banned slavery, and established public education. Item number two, Sweden attempted to establish themselves in the New World, creating New Sweden in Delaware, southern New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania. And item number three, the deadliest war in America in terms of per capita deaths was King Philip's War in New England in 1675-76, which saw the complete destruction of 12 settlements. Bob, go first.
All righty. So, Jesus.
No astronomy here, Bob.
The New Haven colony. I mean, it's New Haven's not far from me, like about an hour or so. Never heard of this New Haven colony of which you speak in 1638. most progressive, huh? I mean, yeah, what the hell? I mean, okay, nothing here. It's not like they set up a space agency to go to the moon, something really goofy. I mean, all that kind of seems plausible. The third one, the deadliest war, never heard of it, but seems 12 settlements destroyed, sure. So it's number two, though, that Sweden? Really? Sweden tried to establish themselves in the New World? Never heard of that. I found this one more surprising than any of the others. So for whatever, I mean, I really have no idea, but I'm just going to – whatever that one tweaked me more than the other one. So I'll just say that the Sweden one is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
New Haven Colony in 1638. Was it the most progressive? And did they actually do these things? Religious freedom, banning slavery, and public education. Like the other two, I have no idea about this. I suppose I wouldn't be surprised about maybe the religious freedom. I might be a little bit surprised about banning slavery, because that seemed – I don't know where exactly we were as far as slavery goes as a trade in exactly that time. I know it was obviously, you know, much more ramped up as the years, decades, century went on. And established public education. Maybe, because it always ties in with the church and the religious freedom. Perhaps that one's right. Sweden attempting to establish themselves in the New World. Yeah, I'd not heard this. I mean, geographically speaking, Delaware, Southern Jersey, Eastern Pennsylvania, all down there, sort of this little, the Delaware. It's the Delaware River that runs up through there, and they would have obviously sailed the ships up the Delaware and got their, planted their flags and stuff there, but I had never heard of this before. Never heard of it. Not even a glimmer of it, and I have no recollection. The last one about the King Philip's War that I have heard of, but I have no recollection of the details. And was it the deadliest per capita? Could be. Yeah, I suppose it definitely could have been. So I guess I'll go with Bob, because I'm just unfamiliar at all with early Swedish settlements. It doesn't quite click. So that's it.
Okay, Jay.
You know, all of these, I have a little bit of stuff bouncing in my head. The New Haven Colony sounds like a diner. right? They guaranteed religious freedom and banned slavery and established public education. 1638. Well, that's very, very progressive. Okay, the next thing, the Swedish. Yeah, I have no reason to doubt this. There was a ton of people from Europe coming over to the continent. So yeah, I believe that one. See, this thing about King Philip's War, I agree with Evan. I've heard of it. I do think I remember a couple of doodads about it, but here's the thing. I don't like Steve saying it was the deadliest war per capita, and if I think there's any phrase in all three of these that I don't like that could screw up like my perception of what he's saying here, it's that. So deadliest war in America in terms of per capita deaths.
The number of deaths is a percentage of the population.
I just don't think that any war is going to come close to the Civil War. Yeah, but I mean, the interesting stat about the Civil War, the American Civil War, was that more Americans died in that war than any other war, of course, because both sides were Americans. You know, the point here is that this was one hell of a deadly war. And I don't know, I don't know. Which saw the complete destruction of 12 settlements. Well, how big could the settlements possibly be?
That means towns. These are towns.
Yeah, fine, towns. But even in the 1600s, back 12 towns early times in this continent. I just don't see the numbers. I don't know. The first two, I can read them and understand and feel like, yep, they make sense. You know, I might even have a memory or two rattling around, probably commingling with Evan's German screw up.
Jawohl.
Who knows? Jawohl. But I'm just going to say three is the fake. I don't like the per capita. I do have information about the Civil War that's kind of making me not believe this one.
Okay, so you all agree with the first one, so we'll start there. New Haven, the New Haven Colony, founded in 1638, was considered the most progressive in New England. Their charter guaranteed religious freedom, banned slavery, and established public education. You all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
I thought this would be the fiction if it wasn't the one, I guess.
Steve! But wait, so there was a New Haven Colony, though,
yes,
right?
The New Haven Colony was founded in 1638. That much is true. But it was the least progressive. It was the most puritanical, the strictest Puritan colony in America at the time.
Wow.
John Davenport was the founder of the New Haven Colony. Wow. He was a very strict Puritan. And the colony's rules included that everything had to be done according to the Bible. The colonists had to pledge to live their lives according to scripture, And in fact, that the original layout of the town was designed to resemble the Temple of Solomon in the New Jerusalem. So he thought that the government should be exemplified by the church, and the laws should be basically the Old Testament laws. You get the idea.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
good
job. You get the idea.
So he was a bad guy, and it was the exact opposite. I said it, if you remember, I said, that's amazingly progressive.
It is.
Oh, boy.
Eventually, the New Haven colony got absorbed into the Connecticut colony, so it just basically became part of Connecticut, and its individual rules went away.
Yeah. So we engulfed and devoured them.
So moving on to the Swedish thing.
No, hang on. There's more though, because Evan asked about the whole slavery thing, so I thought I would tell you about that.
Okay.
Yeah, so no one at that time banned slavery. Who, you guys know what the first government was to ban slavery?
A state or
anywhere in the world. What was the first government in the world to ban slavery?
Well, England was early on. Kind of.
Yeah, it was England.
Great.
Was it England? Okay.
Good guess, Evan.
Yeah. And then in America, it was Vermont in 1777.
Mm.
Wow.
Okay.
The first one.
Wow. Right after. Right. Yeah.
So let's move on to number two. Sweden attempted to establish themselves in the New World, creating New Sweden in Delaware, Southern New Jersey, and Eastern Pennsylvania. That one is science. That's right. I never heard of that either before. I was looking this up. That's really
interesting. I did know about that one.
Yeah, I know, Jay, you have a Sweden connection because of your job for Thule.
Definitely had a Swedish coworker talk to me about that.
Oh, wow.
But is it that surprising, guys? Think about it.
No.
You know, people from Europe coming over, making a colony. You know what I mean? I mean, that's how United States.
Yeah, but in southern New Jersey?
Well, who cares where they move to? I mean, why is that better or worse than any other place along the eastern seaboard?
Do you know anything else about it, Jay?
Yeah, you know, what is it? Lasted like 100 years or something?
No, not even. Not even. No, no, just like a decade.
Oh, it was 10 years? Okay.
Wow.
They were centered in Fort Christina, which still exists, and that's in modern day Wilmington, Delaware. They essentially created a trading company. And they were trying to establish a trading economy with the New World.
So they were Swedes by trade.
By trade, yeah. To trade furs and tobacco, which is what people traded at the time. Mm. Yeah.
I think they traded those cool little things that you put on top of the caravan, those little boxes to carry, put your stuff in, attached to the top of your covered wagon.
It's a cargo box, but yeah, those, you're 300 years too early, man.
Thule.
Governor Thule.
Welcome till Thule. Yeah, so so that is interesting, and they lasted 10 years. So they came over.
17 years.
All right, now you've doubled it. So they came in, they lasted 17 years. So what happened?
Sweden got into trouble with the other Scandinavian countries and lost their ability to maintain a colony.
Got muscled out.
Seven armed Dutch ships and 317 soldiers appeared on the Delaware River. Realizing that resistance would be useless or futile, right? The vastly outnumbered Swedes surrendered Fort Trinity, and Governor Rising surrendered Fort Christina 2 weeks later, and that was the end.
The end.
So then the third one, I was wrong about the deadliest war, huh?
Yeah, so King Philip's War was the deadliest war. This essentially, the quickie history of this war, this was, again, 1675 to 76. Essentially, the British colonists were being jerks to the local Indian tribes.
Yeah, it was Indians.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. They were taking their—
Inconceivable!
They're taking their land and treating them poorly. And then also, the local Native American tribes were becoming increasingly dependent on their trade with the British, and they were trading stuff like furs. And then, but that the trade was drying up. So they were essentially losing their ability to survive because they were running out of stuff to trade to the British. And because the British were using up all their land, they couldn't otherwise survive. So this was like the last ditch effort to expel. They were really trying to expel the British from New England, from like send them back to the old world. This was led by Medicom. Is that interesting? Medicom kind of sounds like a telecommunications company.
I like it. I like that.
Yeah. It's also called Medicom's Rebellion, but he did go by the name King Philip, so that's how it became known, as a kind of a nickname. So this was a number of tribes joined him, and they massively attacked the colonies in southern New England and killed a lot of people. They said that 10% of the military-age males in the colonies were killed during this 14-month war. Literally decimated.
And I believe by contrast, the Civil War was about 2%.
Other tribes, like the Mohegan tribe, the Pequot, the Massachusetts, and the Nauset Indians, they sided with the English. and they were rewarded a couple hundred years later with gambling casinos.
Yeah, saw
that coming.
That's true, actually. Well, it is true.
Yeah, I mean, they sided with the British, and that's why they survived. And the other ones were basically destroyed. They had to flee to Canada, or they were captured and sold into slavery, sent off to the West Indies as slaves. And Metacom was beheaded, and that pretty much ended the that war. And the history is interesting because, of course, that was a brutal response to the native uprising against treating them like, you know, a crap. But, you know, some historians also say that that war actually united the colonies. You know,
yeah.
That it took these disparate colonies, and they were forced to band together to defend themselves, and that was like the first time really that an American colonial identity kind of emerged.
Oh wow, that
in
is
response
really cool.
to that, like, well, yeah, because it was an existential threat. I mean, they had to fight for their very survival, and you could totally see that, right? You know, even today, like when things happen, like a mass shooting or a terrorist attack in a town, like people band together immediately around their local identity. You know, Boston strong or Vegas strong, or after 9/11, like there was American flags everywhere. That's totally what happens. Very interesting.
Very human response.
So, yeah, so Kara jumps ahead and isn't even here this week. Great.
By default.
Exactly.
Right.
She's going to love that.
She dodged a sweep.
You know, Steve, I tried to channel my sweep. Thanksgiving mojo. It didn't work.
No. This wasn't really Thanksgiving related, but just, you know, same time and place.
I love it, though. Yeah, I loved it.
Jay, maybe there'll be a dental one again in the future.
I do love stories about that period in time. Like The Last of the Mohicans, remember that movie? I love that movie. Just because it was so chaotic. It was like the stakes were so high. It was so interesting, everything that was going on at that time.
I love that movie. Yeah. And you swept us, you bastard. So you
I did.
Good job on the sweep.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Everyone is ignorant in some way or another.
Yes.
Ignorance is our deepest secret. And it's one of the scariest things out there, because those of us who are most ignorant are also the ones who often don't know it. Or don't want to admit it. Oh, yes, very, very true. And that was written by Vera Nazarian. And she is a science fiction and fantasy writer.
And when was that written, Evan? Because I'm interested, because that's the Dunning-Kruger effect that she
It is
describing.
The Dunning-Kruger, yeah.
So I just want to know, did she write that before the Dunning-Kruger effect was published, or after?
2010.
Yeah, so that was after.
Yeah, it was after. Yeah, so that was written in, published in October of 2010, her book, after the Dunning-Kruger effect, which we've talked about many times on the show, but it's a nice summary of that exact sentiment.
Yeah, the Dunning-Kruger effect was published in 1999. But yeah, but that's a pithy way of saying it, sure.
And we need not be afraid to admit it, that there is ignorance within all of us.
Yeah. All of us. Yeah.
Whoa, what are you saying, Evan? Holy shit.
I'm saying you're stupid.
You might be
not everyone.
Of what letters appear in the German language, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah,
hey.
Exactly. Yeah. Even stuff that's easy to look up, you know.
Or of the nature of the New Haven colony founded
exactly.
in 1638.
You know, you could even with confidence think you remember things that you don't remember.
Or the that's speed right. of electrons. Or yeah. Gosh, so many things.
Hey, guys.
Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving, by the way. I'm going to be I'll be in Denver with family.
Mile High Turkey.
I know.
We're not going to see you
on Thanksgiving.
Nope.
Hey, guys, we have a new online swag store.
Nice. Yeah, let's talk about it.
I heard
yeah, go
about
to TeePublic, TeePublic.com, and just search on Skeptic's Guide. And we're putting as much of our swag up there as we can. We still have more things to add, but you could buy t-shirts and as well as the usual kinds of stuff that you get at swag stores, right? Like coffee mugs and phone cases, tote bags, things like that.
Yeah, and if you bought anything in our old store, and especially if you're having order issues, then email us, because that store was not supposed to even be active.
But we are trying, yeah, so our goal is to fulfill any of the remaining orders from the old store. But don't send any more orders through that. They're actually, yeah, we're going to remove that from the site. It was really supposed to be inactive. But we'll, and if you don't get that order, like within the next few weeks, if you haven't gotten an outstanding order from the old store, then email us and let us know. Because we want to finish that off and end that. And so everything, all online swag sales will be through TeePublic. They also have a pretty wide selection of other items by independent artists, and we've collected some of our favorite geeky and science related items onto our merchant store, so you can look through there as well. But mainly we're using this as a way to offer our swag online. And if you have any ideas for the kinds of things that you want, then let us know. And if there are anyone out there who wants to send us any fan art they'd like to see us put on the store, we'll be happy to see that too.
And just in case you don't know, we have a Star Trek Discovery review show called Alpha Quadrant 6. And you can go to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/AlphaQuadrant6. And we also have those up on those episodes of our reviews up on our YouTube channel, the Skeptic's Guide YouTube channel. So please go take a look and let us know if you like it. And tell me if you think Steve is good on the show or if he sucks.
Yeah. That's the important thing that we need to know. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank sure, you, man. Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.